This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, listener. I'm Carol Fisher, the host of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister. I'm so excited for you to hear the brand new season where we're uncovering a 35-year-old mystery. But for those of you who didn't hear season one or just want to listen to it again, you can now get access to all episodes of that first season of The Girlfriends 100% ad-free through the iHeart True Crime Plus subscription, which is available exclusively on Apple Podcasts. You'll also get access to every single episode of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, ad-free and 1 week early, only available to iHeart True Crime Plus subscribers. So what are you waiting for? Head to Apple Podcasts, search for iHeart True Crime Plus, and subscribe today.
Hey fam, I'm Simone Boyce.
I'm Danielle Robay.
And we're the hosts of The Bright Side, the podcast from Hello Sunshine that's guaranteed to light up your day.
Like our recent episode with comedian and actor Alana Glazer about leaving behind her 20s and welcoming the next decade.
I'm being a bad girl now. I'm like, oh my gosh, LOL. And to be a bad girl on a solid foundation, you know, it actually just looks like taking pleasure.
Listen to The Bright Side from Hello Sunshine on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, listeners. I'm Andrea Gunning, host of Betrayal. This season on the podcast, we follow Stacey Rutherford, who thought she met her soulmate when she laid eyes on Dr. Justin Rutherford. They fell in love, and it was better than she ever imagined. But this family doctor, beloved father, and treasured husband had dark secrets. He had sworn to do no harm, but would resort to any means necessary to save himself. I'm excited to share this betrayal story with you, and even more excited to tell you that you can get access to all episodes 100% ad-free with an iHeart True Crime Plus subscription, available exclusively on Apple Podcasts. Plus, you'll get access to the next episode 1 week ahead of everyone else, available only to iHeart True Crime Plus subscribers. And you'll also get access to all episodes from Betrayal Season 1 and Season 2 ad-free as well. So don't wait. Head to Apple Podcasts, search for iHeart True Crime Plus, and subscribe today.
Hi, I'm Katie Lowes.
And I'm Guillermo Diaz.
And we're the hosts of Unpacking the Toolbox, the Scandal Rewatch podcast where we're talking about all the best moments of the show.
Mesmerizing.
But also, we get to hang out with all of our old Scandal friends like Bellamy Young, Scott Foley, Tony Goldwyn, Debbie Allen, Kerry Washington.
Well, suit up, gladiators. Grab your big old glass of wine and prepare yourselves for an even more behind-the-scenes stories with Unpacking the Toolbox.
Listen to Unpacking the Toolbox on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts,
or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Lauren Bright Pacheco. This new episode of Wrongful Conviction covers the unbelievable case of Alan Beeman. Such an epic story that we needed to release it as a two-parter. Part one right now and part two coming next week. If you're listening in the Wrongful Conviction feed, stay right here. For those of you who've been listening to these episodes in the Murder in Illinois feed, you'll need to head over to Wrongful Conviction for part two and for the rest of my season with Wrongful Conviction. Tens of thousands of people incarcerated in the U.S. have been wrongfully convicted and are being held in captivity for crimes even as they adamantly maintain their innocence. What's it like to be one of those imprisoned people? And what's it like to be their ally, the one outside committed to fighting for their freedom? I'm Lauren Bright Pacheco, and this is Wrongful Conviction. Alan Beeman was 21 years old when his life was forever altered. Going into his senior year in college, specializing in theatrical lighting design, he suddenly found himself ensnared in a police investigation into the death of his former girlfriend. 22-year-old Jennifer Lockmiller was found dead August 28, 1993, in her apartment in Normal, Illinois. She had been strangled with a clock radio cord and stabbed in the chest with scissors. Even though, at the time, Alan was living with his parents for summer break in Rockford, Illinois, over 130 miles away from the murder, the following May, Normal, Illinois police arrested Beeman on murder charges related to the death of Lockmiller an hour after he completed his final exam, just weeks before what would have been his graduation. Despite the lack of any evidence of his guilt, in 1995, Beeman was convicted of murder and sentenced to 50 years. He would serve 13 years before the Illinois Supreme Court reversed the conviction and the state opted to drop murder charges. It is my pleasure to welcome Alan and his parents, Barry and Carol, to Wrongful Conviction. Thank you guys for joining me.
Thank you for having us. Thanks,
Thank
Lauren.
Thank you for having us.
Now, I want to take a step back, and Alan, let's go back a bit. Just tell me how you would describe your upbringing and your family before all of this happened.
I grew up in a household that was very conservative and very involved in our community. I was raised to take the high road, to treat my neighbors with respect and dignity, and to withhold judgment until I've gotten to know a person.
And what were your passions growing up? What were you obsessed with?
We grew up out in the country, surrounded by pastures and cornfields. You know, you hear people talk about Generation X being the feral children, and I was exactly that. Left the house at 7 in the morning and didn't come back until 7 o'clock at night. And if my parents saw me in between, it was because I was either hungry or had to go to the bathroom.
Or both.
From the age of 4, I was swinging a hammer. My parents and I and my brother built our house.
Really?
I was driving floorboard nails. And if it wasn't something that was safe for me to do, like a circular saw, I was still being instructed on how to do it. My mom was a teacher and used a very Socratic method and got me to explore the things that I was curious about without trying to tell me what to think. So, you know, I'm certainly grateful to them for that upbringing and for the support they've given me over the years.
Wow, I can't believe you guys built your house together. That is definition of a hands-on family.
With a lot of help from our friends and family.
And Barry, I know that Carol was a teacher, but what was your profession by trade?
I started with a degree in physics from Illinois Wesleyan University, and that led me into the Air Force. After I got out of the Air Force, I ended up spending the rest of my career as a quality engineer, both in mechanical activities and in software.
So, Alan, you have an engineer for a father, teacher for a mother. How did you end up getting drawn to theatrical lighting design?
My mom told me that I was very dramatic. And I started getting involved with the drama club in middle school. I think getting involved in theater and just being naturally handy, I got appointed to do things. Oh, you know how to do this. Okay, here you go. But as I got even older, going into college, I just lost interest in the performance side and really got sucked into the technical aspects, especially lighting.
I've read that you were able to combine your love of music with a vision you had for your ultimate career in terms of working on design for concerts eventually.
By the time I was in college, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do lighting design for rock bands. Not that I wouldn't want to do that for plays and other things as well, but I think I always verged on the motion of lighting. So I think I would have naturally gravitated towards lighting for music, a feature of that.
That takes us really pretty much to right about when your family was abruptly altered by what ended up befalling Alan. So you're 21 years old and you're just weeks away from graduation, about to start your adult life. How prepared were you or your family for what you'd collectively go through for the decades that would follow?
We were not prepared at all to deal with the legal conundrums that came upon us.
Not at all.
Growing up in that rural conservative environment, I was raised to trust law enforcement. We did not ever perceive it as a hostile element that would overtake our lives and attempt to destroy us.
For me, my experience was just with the police officers that served in my school, and they were my helpers if I had difficulty in a classroom. It wasn't something that even entered my mind in terms of entanglement with the police.
So just to set then the stage, Alan, just in terms of your relationship with Jennifer, how long had you guys dated? How long had you known each other? Were you in contact at the time of her murder?
I met Jennifer, I want to say, in the spring of my sophomore year in college, when we were both going to Illinois Wesleyan. And we were friends. Nothing romantic occurred until the summer after that school year. And we started dating later in that summer. And then throughout my junior year, we dated for about a year. And we broke up about a month before she was murdered.
So just that circumstance probably made you a little bit of an easy target in terms of a lazy investigation. But how would you categorize your relationship and the way it ended? Was it volatile, or was there animosity?
What you're asking there is speaking to the initial suspicion. We had an on-again, off-again relationship. We broke up several times. There were a lot of public conflicts that we had in front of other people, friends, and even family. And so I think it was only natural for a police investigator to initially say, hey, we got to talk to this guy. And if that had been where it ended, it would have made perfect sense. Unfortunately, as you mentioned, the potential for a lazy investigation with that, you know, the statistics probably tell them that most of the time it's the ex-boyfriend. And that's great. That gives you a lead to start with, but that is not evidence. That should not be indicative of probable cause. And so I think they just jumped to that conclusion very early on and did not go through the steps that are necessary to rule things out with scientific method.
Do you remember how you collectively found out this had happened in the first place?
At the time of the murder, how we found out. It started with a knock at the door. Alan had just left to go meet some friends at Denny's who were leaving for college the next day. And within the hour of that knock on the door, we received a phone call from the county jail where they had Alan for questioning. And Alan said he had been allowed to call us, and he told us he was being questioned about something and he didn't know where his car was and could we come pick him up. He had been picked up on the road going into town to meet his friends and questioned.
And that was about 2 o'clock in the morning, as I recall.
Yes.
So you thought your son was out with friends and he was actually at the police station. Alan, how did you were just pulled over?
Yeah, I was about halfway to the city limits when I noticed that there was a squad car behind me. I tried very hard to make sure I drove exactly the speed limit while he was behind me, and then crossed over into the city limits and was immediately pulled over. So then I thought, I have long hair, or, you know, I thought it was the typical stuff that I had experienced while in college. But this time the officer was standing in front of me with his sidearm drawn, and there was a police dog. And I was told to get out of the car. They patted me down and then maybe asked if there were any weapons.
What was going through your head?
I was in shock. I really didn't have a coherent thought going on in my head. But when I was placed in the squad car, I finally gathered up my senses and I asked the officer, hey, can you tell me what this is about? and he said some detectives from Normal want to talk to you about a homicide. So I'm in shock, sitting in the squad car, thinking, who do I know in Normal that could have possibly been involved in a homicide to where they want to talk to me? And I could think of a few people. And then, of course, there was Jennifer. I stayed in that squad car right there until a detective's car came up, and it had passengers who were Tony Daniels, a detective from Normal, and Tony's partner. I got into that car. I was still handcuffed.
So you're handcuffed. They've not told you why, what you've been accused of. Nothing.
Nothing. I know I'm in handcuffs and they want to talk to me about a homicide. And I guess if I were a little more streetwise, I would have realized that I was a suspect. But I didn't grow up in the environment where I ever expected to be a suspect. I didn't know what was going on. I'm just supposed to speak when I'm spoken to and respect the police officers who are doing their job.
But even though you had long hair, you didn't exactly have a long rap sheet. In fact, you had no criminal history.
That is correct.
When did they tell you that Jennifer had been murdered, and how did they tell you?
When I got into the squad car with Tony Daniels, I asked him, what is this about? And he simply said, well, Alan, we want to talk to you about your friend. And it seemed very cryptic to me. I felt like he did not really want to answer my question yet. And so I opted to be polite and, again, respect law enforcement, and I did not press the issue. We rode back to the police station in Rockford, and I was placed in an interrogation room with a couple of chairs and a table and questioned.
For how long before you could call your parents?
I want to say it was about an hour and a half. And he gave me my Miranda rights and all that, and I probably could have walked out right then and there. But again, that's not something you do when you've grown up to respect law enforcement and you've got nothing to hide. And he started asking me questions. And most of the questions were either about my whereabouts throughout the week or about Jennifer. And eventually I could figure out from the line of questioning something was going on with Jennifer. And they had told me there was a homicide, and so I pieced that together. And he challenged me, like, how come you haven't asked me if she's okay? And I said, is Jennifer dead? And he said, yes. And I, again, still in shock, but now even more so in shock, and being accused of now knowing something that I'm not supposed to know just because I can put pieces together. And so he did this whole very sort of evasive and then accusatory and then evasive and then accusatory. And he would tell me one thing and then he would change it and tell me, oh no, that's not really what it is. It's this. And so he told me she was dead. He told me she was alive in a hospital calling my name. After about an hour and a half of this interview, where it really didn't seem like he was interested in hearing what I really had to say, but was just trying to provoke me and wanted me to say what he wanted me to say, I finally said, you said that I'm not under arrest, so that means I don't have to stay, so I'm leaving. And I got up and I left. But I walked out of the police station and I didn't know where my car was. And I could find a payphone, and so I called my parents.
So all of this, at this point, early morning drama, did it ever occur to you, Barry, or you, Carol, that this was anything other than a horrible event and a crazy misunderstanding? Did you think that was it in terms of what Alan had just been through?
The next day, Alan was supposed to sing at church. And we asked him when we got him home, what are you going to do about that? And do you want us to call and cancel? And he said, no, he was going to go ahead. We went to church and he did his solo. And then we talked to our pastor about what do we do next. And he got us in touch with a lawyer, a family friend, who kind of advised Alan at that point and advised us to just keep Alan away from the police at that time. And they did show up at our house.
Sunday afternoon. My father and I were trying to move a cabinet into the house that my parents had brought from their home to us. And these two huge men walked up and said, "Can we help you with that?" And picked it up and moved it in for us. Set it in the corner and then told us they'd like to talk to Alan. And I said, "I got some concerns about this."
And you all knew that, Alan, you were, what, over 130 miles, closer to 140 miles away from the scene of where this tragedy occurred, and you're living at home for the summer. So I should think that you all just thought, obviously, it was impossible that you were involved.
We all believed in my family that the detectives would do their job, investigate the case, and they are professionals and they know what they're doing, and that at a certain point they would realize, yeah, this is the wrong way to go, and that they would move on. Unfortunately, I think, you know, and I'm editorializing here, there was so much pressure on the department and on the county to find someone that when their investigation broke down and their ability to properly investigate failed, they just decided, we got this guy here. He looks pretty crazy. We can probably make him look bad. And that's our guy.
Alan, you mentioned having long hair and your sense of righteous indignation was also growing. How do you think that combination could have made things worse for you?
I was a dirty hippie in college. And I think, you know, it did probably add to the opportunity to make me a target. But I was also really frustrated that they were accusing me of something I didn't do. And I was very angry about that. And I reacted poorly, which should be understandable coming from an adolescent, essentially, who's being accused of something. And
dealing with grief.
Well, I was denied that. I couldn't grieve because I learned about her death by being accused of murdering her. Mm-hmm. And I never had the opportunity to experience a neutral individual perception of her death to say, you know, man, somebody that I cared about has died and I'm really grieving. And even though things didn't end great between us, I didn't wish this on her. You know, I didn't have the opportunity to do that. And under the circumstances with the police scrutiny and the obvious perception that went along with that, I didn't feel comfortable going to the funeral. I didn't feel comfortable interacting with other people that loved her. And so I was very much alone in my grief, and I couldn't really explore it with other people who had the same feeling.
Which also played into the narrative.
Exactly. That was, again, further used against me. And so they had a lot of opportunity to say, oh, he's really fishy. Something's not right. And unfortunately, in the current state of our legal system, that is what passes for evidence.
So you end up going back to school, and Carol and Barry, you have been staunch defenders of your son and supporters of him and adamant believers in his innocence. Did the police ever try to manipulate your opinion of your son or try to cast doubt on him or his character?
No, they did not. In fact, Lieutenant Daniels, who was the lead detective coming to Rockford to talk to Alan, concluded by the time he left Rockford that Alan probably didn't do it. And he held that belief throughout the trial as well.
Wow.
And eventually, through depositions and things like that, became one of Alan's top cheerleaders.
So the nightmare certainly didn't end when you went back for your senior year. You go back and you're trying to focus on finishing up your degree, and the police are continuing to pop in. How and when did they show up, and how invasive was it in terms of your ability to be a student?
It was always a surprise when they showed up. They occasionally would have somebody from campus security with them, sanctioning and supervising their visit to the campus. But I think the first time I met Tim Friesmeier was outside the theater, and I think he kind of was lying in wait for me to come out a door that I typically used. So the first time I met him, he served a warrant to collect biological samples from me. And my thought was, this is good. They're collecting actual evidence. That means that they have something to compare this to, and my worries will be over. They will realize, okay, it wasn't him. And so, you know, I didn't put up any fuss. I just went with them and I was like, all right, this is great. And they took me to the hospital and had a technician take samples from me. Then after those were taken, they took me back to the police station and fingerprinted me and took the infamous photograph of me that eventually appeared in the newspaper, making me look very rough and scruffy. I should add, they picked me up in the middle of Tech Week for a show that I was designing for, and I had not slept the night before. I had not slept much that week at all. I had not bathed very much that week at all. I had not shaved. I had not brushed my teeth that night. I was disgusting, even more so than usual. And that's when they took the picture of me that they later put in the newspaper.
So are you looping your parents in about the frequent visitors in your life at that point? Are you trying to protect them?
Yeah.
Yes, trying to protect, not loop.
Yes, to protecting. I didn't believe it was really a big problem because I was so confident that they were going to rule me out and move on.
Did you guys, though, pick up on the fact that it was impacting Alan emotionally?
We did not. However, we went down to campus one weekend to see the show that he had been working on. He wasn't there. He was over in Peoria at a friend's wedding that weekend. And we went to the show, and one of Alan's faculty advisors said, "Do you realize how often he's being questioned?" And that's the first we knew that he was being questioned frequently. And also on that first, we found out that he was being taken out of classes from a professor who had a no-cut policy, which eventually impacted Alan's graduation as well.
And then you get arrested. Can you tell me how and when that went down?
It was on my last day, my last final exam for my theater history class. And when I left the final exam, I went to the dining hall. And while I was sitting eating my dinner, Tim Friesmeier came into the dining hall, walked up to me and said, "Hey, can I talk to you for a minute?" And so I was like, "Fine, let's go talk." And so I walked out of the dining hall with him, and I was walking towards a door that I typically use that would get us outside. And he was like, "No, we need to go this way." So I followed him to the other side of the building, and when we walked out of the door, there was like 20 squad cars out there, just a whole bunch of cops out there. But I just remember looking around and seeing cops everywhere. So I thought, okay, this is different. And he said, "I need you to come down to the station with me." And I said, "I don't think I want to go down to the station with you." And he said, "I'm going to have to place you under arrest if you're not going to come with me." And I said, "Then you need to arrest me here." So he handcuffed me right there in front of the student center, in front of all of my classmates and professors and people coming and going around the campus, put me in his car and took me to the normal police department. And I don't even know how that works with jurisdiction, because it was actually in Bloomington. But I think he just wanted to be credited for the arrest or something. I don't know. But he took me back to normal and then booked me there, and I made my phone call.
Tell me about that phone call, you guys. Who answered the phone, Carol or Barry?
Carol did.
I did. I had just gotten home from my last graduate class, and found out that my thesis had been accepted. And I honestly can't tell you at this point whether we spoke in person or whether you had left a message on the phone. But it was, get in touch with Bill, my lawyer. I've been arrested. And that was the end of my celebration of graduation. And Barry was at a meeting at the Public Observatory. And I called Bill right away. And I called Barry at the observatory. And within an hour, we were on our way to Normal to try to get Alan out. We couldn't. We had to wait a while to get him out. But that was a drastic change to life at that point.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything. A moment that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these very moments.
The last couple of years has been the hardest season of our marriage for sure. I'm surprised our marriage survived it. I think we both are. I think we both were barely holding on. Nothing compares to how hard this is.
Their stories are full of candor, awe, and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change.
True behavior change is really identity change. Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become.
Listen to A Slight Change of Plans on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When the Taliban banned music in Afghanistan, millions were plunged into silence. Radios were smashed, cassettes burned. You could be beaten or jailed or killed for breaking the rules. And yet, Afghans did it anyway. This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, listeners. I'm Andrea Gunning, host of Betrayal. This season on the podcast, we follow Stacey Rutherford, who thought she met her soulmate when she laid eyes on Dr. Justin Rutherford. They fell in love, and it was better than she ever imagined. But this family doctor, beloved father, and treasured husband had dark secrets. He had sworn to do no harm, but would resort to any means necessary to save himself. I'm excited to share this betrayal story with you, and even more excited to tell you that you can get access to all episodes 100% ad-free with an iHeart True Crime Plus subscription, available exclusively on Apple Podcasts. Plus, you'll get access to the next episode 1 week ahead of everyone else, available only to iHeart True Crime Plus subscribers. And you'll also get access to all episodes from Betrayal Season 1 and Season 2 ad-free as well. So don't wait. Head to Apple Podcasts, search for iHeart True Crime Plus, and subscribe today.
Hey fam, I'm Simone Boyce.
I'm Danielle Robay.
And we're the hosts of The Bright Side, the podcast from Hello Sunshine that's guaranteed to light up your day.
And we can't wait for you to hear our recent episode with actor, activist, and 90s icon, Tatiana Ali.
Something got freed up in me where it was just like, do what you imagine, because this is all imagination anyway.
Listen to The Bright Side from Hello Sunshine on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
In that moment of finding out that your son had been arrested, when you got in the car and you drove there, what was that reality like for you? That kind of sense of helplessness to realize that you can't just say, you've made a mistake, he's my son, and he's coming home with us. What was that helplessness like for you guys? How would you explain it?
Total frustration.
Determination on my part. There had to be a way.
How long did they hold you there before I assume that you posted bond?
I was in the county jail, I want to say maybe 10 days.
Yeah, probably.
Until the arraignment.
There was a bond hearing and several of my classmates were called and some of my family members were called to testify about what sort of person I was, to help the court determine, I guess, whether I was a flight risk or whether there was some risk that I might harm some other person if I were out on bond and those sorts of things. The state's attorney, of course, tried to get it to where there was no bond, and my attorney asked for a bond, but the judge set the bond at $1 million. So at that point, I thought, well, this is not going to happen. But my uncle owned several grocery stores, and he made the decision to take money out of that business. If you have a $1 million bond, it means you need to put up $100,000 to be able to bond out.
Mm-hmm.
And so he put up the money from his businesses and risked those businesses. And he wasn't a rich man. He had a good business that he had built over many years and worked very hard to build. And he did that for me, and I'm forever grateful.
It's the ripple effect of these injustices, how they impact.
The uncle Alan was talking about is my brother. I'm the baby sister. He's 93 now, but he was determined that he was going to help us whatever way he could. And so I guess I knew family sticks together. And if it's in God's will, it will happen. And it takes a long time sometimes. But yeah, a lot of frustration and a lot of concern, but always determination that this was going to be taken care of.
What was the transition like for you, Alan, in those 10 days before you bonded out? What was it like being held?
I reacted very irrationally to the confinement and probably rationally to the injustice. I was very angry and terrified at the same time. I was desperately pleading with anybody that walked past my cell that there had been a terrible mistake and that they had the wrong guy. I was going through nicotine withdrawal and just absolutely beside myself about the wrongness of my circumstances. I just panicked. Whenever I talked to my parents on the phone, I was not very nice. I demanded that they get me out of here, and it was not my proudest moment. And I don't know how much processing I did with any of it at that time. There's a lot that I've gone through in the last 30 years that I still haven't completely processed as far as that's concerned.
Understandably.
He was angry. He was scared. And we were scared for him.
I was feeling like a failure as a father. I couldn't do anything to get him out of there.
I do remember that we were told we could bring him some clothes. Long underwear. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to make sure he was warm because he said it was cold in the cell. Other than that's one of those odd things you remember.
Yeah, no, because you want to provide whatever comfort in a situation like that you can. What were some of the realizations, the realities you had to come to terms with as you headed into trial? What most surprised you about that process? And Carol, why don't you start?
I'm not sure anything really surprised us, other than I couldn't figure out why the logic of everything didn't make sense to the jurors.
It has been professionally compared to the trial of the Knave from Lewis Carroll, where everything that came up was obviously suspicious. This is suspicious, and that is suspicious, and oh my gosh, he's defending himself. That is suspicious, and he's angry about being accused. That is suspicious, and there was a consistent pattern throughout the entire trial that there was no evidence. It was entirely made up of conjecture. They would take excerpts from letters that I had written, and they would leave out the parts of the letter that didn't fit with what they wanted, and only present the parts of the letter that they felt could make me look bad. I had been scribbling on the back of her address book, and I don't even remember when this was. It may have been early on in our relationship, it may have been later, but Pearl Jam's 10 had just come out, and I was trying to write down the lyrics to the song. And you remember back when you didn't have the internet, you had to play the tape, stop it, rewind it, play it again, and try. And Eddie Vedder is really hard to understand sometimes. And so I was writing down the lyrics to the song Black, and they found that at her apartment, and they accused me of writing it as a poem about her. And so I probably should have been felt honored to be accused of being Eddie Vedder. It for me, capitalized the ridiculousness and the ignorance that went into the developing of their case.
In terms of how Alan was then portrayed, am I right in recalling that they actually compared you to Adolf Hitler in the closing statements?
You are correct.
Oh, yes.
During the closing arguments, Jim Suk not only compared me to Adolf Hitler, but also quoted scripture from the Bible about how the devil is a roaring lion going about to seek whomever he may destroy. There's so much theater involved in the way this case was prosecuted, and probably most cases involve some level of that, and I understand that, but there was no evidence. And this is the frustrating thing, is that you can get up and you can just present nothing but conjecture and suspicion and get everybody all upset with the comparisons, and the jury will remove themselves from their responsibility to actually expect proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Because then it becomes emotional.
I did not expect that. I genuinely walked into this trial believing that I was going to be vindicated because the evidence did not point to me.
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction with Lauren Bright Pacheco. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything. A moment that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these very moments.
The last couple of years has been the hardest season of our marriage, for sure. I'm surprised our marriage survived it. I think we both are. I think we both were barely holding on. Nothing compares to how hard this is.
Their stories are full of candor, awe, and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change.
True behavior change is really identity change. Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become.
Listen to A Slight Change of Plans on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When the Taliban banned music in Afghanistan, Millions were plunged into silence. Radios were smashed, cassettes burned. You could be beaten or jailed or killed for breaking the rules. And yet, Afghans did it anyway. This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, fam. I'm Simone Boyce.
I'm Danielle Robay.
And we're the hosts of The Bright Side, the daily podcast from Hello Sunshine that is guaranteed to light up your day.
Every weekday, we bring you conversations with the culture makers who inspire us.
Like our recent episode with comedian and actor Alana Glazer about leaving her 20s behind and embracing her 30s.
I'm being a bad girl now. Also, I'm like, oh my gosh, LOL. And to be a bad girl on a solid foundation, you know, it actually just looks like taking pleasure.
Listen to The Bright Side from Hello Sunshine on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
Hi, listeners. I'm Andrea Gunning, host of Betrayal. This season on the podcast, we follow Stacey Rutherford, who thought she met her soulmate when she laid eyes on Dr. Justin Rutherford. They fell in love, and it was better than she ever imagined. But this family doctor, beloved father, and treasured husband had dark secrets. He had sworn to do no harm, but would resort to any means necessary to save himself. I'm excited to share this betrayal story with you, and even more excited to tell you that you can get access to all episodes 100% ad-free with an iHeart True Crime Plus subscription, available exclusively on Apple Podcasts. Plus, you'll get access to the next episode 1 week ahead of everyone else, available only to iHeart True Crime Plus subscribers. And you'll also get access to all episodes from Betrayal Season 1 and Season 2 ad-free as well. So don't wait. Head to Apple Podcasts, search for iHeart True Crime Plus, and subscribe today.
So take me to the moment of the verdict.
The trial was about 3 weeks, and the jury deliberated for more than a couple of days. And I think we were going into the Final Four or tournament.
It was the weekend of the Final Four tournament, April 1st.
And on April Fool's Day, I was a real April Fool for believing that our justice system was going to vindicate me.
Wow.
When the verdict was read, I mouthed to the state's attorney, which I should not have done. It's a wonder I didn't get reprimanded for it. How do you sleep at night? But that's as they were handcuffing Alan back and taking him out to where we would not see him again for a long time.
What went through your body, Barry, when you heard a guilty verdict?
I heard the judge reading it, and I could swear to this day that as he started to read that, he said, "This says guilty," as if to say, "I didn't expect that." And I will also point out that all the women on that jury were crying as that verdict was read. What's that tell you?
I do remember after the verdict was read, there was an audible gasp in the room collectively. And then it was pretty quickly chaos after that, where bailiffs were moving through the room towards me, and people were standing up, and I looked behind me, you know, after collecting myself to encourage my family and say, hey, I'm going to be okay. Just the motion, just the step I took towards my family as I stood up was too much for the police officers in the room. And I was immediately affronted from several directions by officers yelling, "Move it!" and pushing me out of the room into the bullpen. And of course, I had been coming in on my own recognizance throughout that trial. And so this was a very sudden change and a very drastic, almost violent interaction.
Mm-hmm. Immediately.
Immediately.
You're seen as an entirely different human.
Not human.
I was in just a state of disbelief at that point. And I do remember walking out of there. We'd been fairly willing to talk to the press during a lot of this. We didn't say a lot, but we talked with them, and they're standing there with their microphones and everything, and I'd just wave and say, "No, not now. We can't talk now." And we walked on out.
You were sentenced to 50 years?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
To life, which at that point in your lives, Carolyn Barry, was a very much a life sentence for both of you.
Yes.
I can't even imagine how you processed that.
I just felt my life's over. I have no right to go do anything or be anything from this point on.
And I can very much understand the struggle because, mm-hmm, as another mother told me, she served every single day with her daughter in a different way. Mm-hmm. Her life, yeah, stopped.
Now, for me, it was a little different. They got my dander up at that point. I got angry, and I was determined that I was going to do whatever I could to help defend Alan and to get him out.
And eventually they did, but it would take more than a decade. Coming up on part two of Alan Beeman's unbelievable wrongful conviction, Alan's case attracts the attention of a very famous criminal defense attorney.
Jeff Erdangen called my mom and told her, "I don't like him, but I believe him."
Which leads to an equally incredible opportunity to enlist law students on his behalf.
He said, "I've got a chance to go to Northwestern, and I can take along a case."
But even with all that help, Alan Beeman would still sit in prison for 13 years and fight for decades more to clear his name, all ending in a headline-making settlement, but not necessarily justice. Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. I'm Lauren Bright Pacheco. Please support your local innocence organizations and go to the links in the episode description to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our executive producers, Jason Flom, Jeff Kempler, and Kevin Wardis, as well as our producers, Annie Chelsea, Kathleen Fink, and Jackie Pauly. This series is produced, edited, and hosted by me, Lauren Bright Pacheco. Our senior producer is Kara Kornhaber. Story editing by Hannah Beal. Research by Shelby Sorrells. Mixing and sound design by Nick Massetti, with additional production by Jeff Clyborn. Our theme music is by Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on all platforms at Lauren Bright Pacheco. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
This is the story of how a group of people brought music back to Afghanistan by creating their own version of American Idol. The joy they brought to the nation.
You're free completely. No one is there to destroy you.
The danger they endured.
They said my head should be cut off.
I'm John Legend. Listen to Afghan Star on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, listeners. I'm Andrea Gunning, host of Betrayal.
This season on the podcast, we follow Stacey Rutherford, who thought she met her soulmate when she laid eyes on Dr. Justin Rutherford. They fell in love, and it was better than she ever imagined. But this family doctor, beloved father, and treasured husband had dark secrets. He had sworn to do no harm, but would resort to any means necessary to save himself. I'm excited to share this betrayal story with you, and even more excited to tell you that you can get access to all episodes 100% ad-free with an iHeart True Crime Plus subscription, available exclusively on Apple Podcasts. Plus, you'll get access to the next episode 1 week ahead of everyone else, available only to iHeart True Crime Plus subscribers. And you'll also get access to all episodes from Betrayal Season 1 and Season 2 ad-free as well. So don't wait. Head to Apple Podcasts, search for iHeart True Crime Plus, and subscribe today.
Hey fam, I'm Simone Boyce.
I'm Danielle Robay.
And we're the hosts of The Bright Side, the podcast from Hello Sunshine that's guaranteed to light up your day.
Like our recent episode with Jacqueline Novak, host of your other favorite podcast, Poog.
What would you do if you knew you couldn't fail? That sounds simple, but if you actually go, wait, if I knew I couldn't fail, you might think of something that you just have not allowed yourself to think of before. Because you just are so sure that you would fail at it that you've never even considered it. That was kind of how I started doing stand-up.
Listen to The Bright Side from Hello Sunshine on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, listener. I'm Carol Fisher, the host of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister. I'm so excited for you to hear the brand new season where we're uncovering a 35-year-old mystery. But for those of you who didn't hear season one or just want to listen to it again, you can now get access to all episodes of that first season of The Girlfriends 100% ad-free through the iHeart True Crime Plus subscription, which is available exclusively on Apple Podcasts. You'll also get access to every single episode of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, ad-free and 1 week early, only available to iHeart True Crime Plus subscribers. So what are you waiting for? Head to Apple Podcasts, search for iHeart True Crime Plus, and subscribe today.
Hi, I'm Katie Lowes.
And I'm Guillermo Diaz.
And we're the hosts of Unpacking the Toolbox, the Scandal Rewatch podcast where we're talking about all the best moments of the show.
Mesmerizing.
But also, we get to hang out with all of our old Scandal friends like Bellamy Young, Scott Foley, Tony Goldwyn, Debbie Allen, Kerry Washington.
Well, suit up, gladiators. Grab your big old glass of wine and prepare yourselves for an even more behind-the-scenes stories with Unpacking the Toolbox.
Listen to Unpacking the Toolbox on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts,
or wherever you get your podcasts.